Hanukkah is coming. Light up your Hanukkah with a free ticket to Israel. 8 nights, 8 flights. Ura is giving away 8 free tickets to Israel. Every day for the 8 days of Hanukkah at 12 noon Eastern Standard Time, we are raffling off 1 round-trip ticket to Israel. 8 free tickets in total. Just go to ura.org for your free chance to win. There's absolutely no purchase necessary. Plus, you get a bonus. For each friend that you refer to this raffle, you get an extra entry. So hurry before it's too late. Enter the 8 nights, 8 flights raffle now at ura.org. That's OORAH.org. Again, OORA, OORAH.org.
All right. You are listening to the Weekend Edition here at IsraelNationalRadio.com. Israel fighting a war in the southern part of the country. Our citizens in bomb shelters. And we have a population in the Gaza Strip who is choosing to do evil, targeting our civilians as we try only to target their leadership. It shows a difference between good and evil and what is just and unjust. And here to take that a little bit further on a more individual level for all of us, we have Rabbi Fishel Jacobs with us. He is working now on a new project with some other people about the two kings. And basically, this is through games, books, CDs, and other items that they're making to develop a new type of, I don't know, like, would you call it like the Sesame Street or the what are they called? The Teletubbies or Barney the Dinosaur, some type of vehicle to teach children self-discipline and how they can choose justice and good over immediate desires and evil. And it's called The Two Kings, and there's a good king, and then there's the king who wants everything now. Which one are they going to feed? Which one are they going to develop? And this is what we want to do with our children today, because we see our kids growing up so quickly today, our kids doing adult things which they should not be doing. And it's all because of, well, it gives me pleasure, I'm going to do it. But we have to refocus our children on ethics, morality, and what is best for them and for the world. This is one of the ways. The Two Kings. If you have children, if you know someone has children, you're going to want to find out about this. Let's welcome to the show Rabbi Fishel Jacobs.
How you doing?
Hey, I'm doing very, very good. And so tell us a bit more about your project. How did you get the idea to do this, and where is it going right now?
Okay, first of all, have a happy holiday.
Chanukah Sameach to you.
And to all of your listeners.
May we win our enemies like we did in days of old.
Amen. The Two Kings series came out. The Two Kings series has been in development for a number of years. Years ago, we used to put on a play with the same theme. The play was based around a concept. First of all, the concept of Two Kings is something which is from Ecclesiastes. It's from the Book of Kehelet, the chapter 9. And the concept is that the body is considered... There, the body is considered like a small city, and Shlomo HaMelech says that the small city has two kings who want to rule over the inhabitants. They want to rule
okay,
over.
Okay, so when you say Shlomo HaMelech, you mean King Solomon, because not everybody here understands Hebrew.
Okay, so King Solomon actually says that the body is compared to a small city, and it has inhabitants. There are resources. There's money. There's things in the city. And both kings want to rule over it, a powerful bad king and a good king. And the similarity to the body is that we have eyes, we have ears, we have a heart, we have limbs. Those are the inhabitants, and the two kings are fighting over it to rule over it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the conceptual background to the concepts of two kings. Years ago, we put on a little play for children. It was a national play. We put it on all over Israel. We put it on over in the United States in front of summer camps. We put it on in front of schools. It was a very, very well-accepted play. It was played in front of tens of thousands of kids. And about 3 or 4 years ago, the idea of putting it on paper and showing it in book form as an educational tool, as you so well explained earlier, it came into our heads. I discussed it with some of the rabbis I work with. I discussed it with my family. I discussed it with some friends of mine, and we started production. We started production of this. We started production. We needed graphics. We decided to start from ages, aiming towards ages 7 till 10. The first book just hit the stores. The book is just the first installment hit the stores about 2 weeks ago. The distributor slash publisher that we're working with at this time right now, we hope to continue with him, is Israel Bookshop. He's located in Lakewood, New Jersey. A very fine man. The
owner, are you in Israel or in America?
Excuse me?
Are you in Israel or America?
I'm right now in Israel.
You're in Israel. Okay, right. So tell us, like, if I were to play this for my young child, what is going to attract them to, you know, seeing a king, the good king and the bad king and inside? Like, why are they going to like it?
They're going to like it. Well, the first thing that they're going to like is that we were very, very fortunate. We found the perfect graphic company to work with. We found a company actually based in India, and we worked with them with the concept. We worked over how we wanted the bad king to look. We worked over with them how we wanted the good king to look. And we found the perfect company, and after a lot of development, a lot of trial and error, we finally got it down. What your child would see when he sees the first installment of the book, and all of the books will have this same theme. There's a child. The story is based around a child. There's always a child in the center. The child has a task to perform. In the first installment, Mommy goes out shopping, and she asks her son to watch the baby in the carriage because the father's in the other room resting. And then the child hears friends are playing outside, and they call him to come out and play ball, but he can't because he's got a chore to do. He's got to watch the baby. And then we see the two kings come into the play. We actually see the two kings right now in book form. Eventually, we're going to see them on DVD form and CD form. And in movie form, but right now we see them in book form, and we see the bad king with his little red robe and his little hat. He comes in, and he tries to entice the little boy, and he says, "It's not so bad. You can go outside, and you should go outside and take the baby with you.
And don't listen to your mommy."
And you can listen to your mommy at the same time, because she didn't say you have to watch the baby inside. She didn't really mean that.
It sounds like a lawyer finding loopholes. So why don't you just make him the lawyer? The lawyer and the... Okay.
The lawyer.
All right. So I like these. So is there drama in the story? Like, does a kid actually not do it, and then they find out that they got into a big amount of trouble and they can't get themselves out, and they're yelling, "Mommy, Daddy, help me," and then they learn their lesson. They should never listen to the bad king?
That's a good point. Our present thinking is there's always tension. And until the end of the story, we don't know who he's going to listen to, because, as we say, in every episode, the bad king has his enticements, and the good king obviously is trying to convince him to the right thing. Our present thinking in the first book, and the second book is ready for print also. In both books, the child listens only to the good king. In the end, our current thinking is that's going to remain that way, although. There will be ups and downs. There will be ups and downs. There will be fallings. It will be human to that degree that we all have our fallings. So presently the child, the good king, wins. But we're going to have to stay tuned to see how that plays out.
You can take this anywhere. It sounds actually interesting. I'd like you all, if you're in front of a computer now, to go to www.2kingsonline.com. 2kingsonline, it's all one word, .com. And you can see there the characters. It's really good animation, something that's very, you know, candy to the eyes for kids to see, even for me to see. And you know, I was remarking to you, Rabbi, we're speaking with Rabbi Fishel Jacobs, that the bad king looks like Ehud Barak. He does. I'm telling you, go there, folks, and see. Look at the bad king. He's got even got that like little beauty mark that he got removed from his face, you know. It's over there. But anyway, not that Ehud Barak is a bad king, by the way. I'm not Nothing to do with this. Nothing to do with this. I'm just remarking. But it's great graphics. You know, I have to tell you, when I tell my kids a bedtime story and we're in the dark and I'm not reading because it's in the dark and I'm just making things up for my imagination, I also do things about a little kid and his mommy told him not to do this and his daddy told him not to do that, but he wanted to do it. And then he does it and he goes off into the forest and he meets the big bad witch, right? And she's just about to eat him, blah, blah, blah. My kids love the story, by the way. My kids don't get frightened by it. They love it. They thrive on it. I used to love witch stories when I was a kid. But anyway, and then the father and mother come and save them somehow, whatever, and they learn a lesson. I'm never going to not do what you say again, mommy and daddy, whatever. So this is really good because here they've got the book in front of them. They can see it, and they can probably be, you can probably be a lot more constructive than I can with my dumb little, you know, stories that I tell my kids. This is something that will really is planned out, thought out, and will really gear the kid in the right direction, right?
We had an interesting thing. I had a conversation with a fellow in Delaware about 5 months ago, and we're looking for some companies who are going to be producing our tie-in products and the shirts and frisbees and balls with the Good King on it. And I found a company in Delaware, and I was speaking to this fellow, a really, really nice fellow. And I was describing the concept behind the two kings. And at one time we had a conversation that lasted about 2-3 months, and we were very, very friendly. And one time he turns around and he says to me, you know, the truth is that I used to go, I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous veteran. He graduated from that about 15 years ago. And he said that he developed in his own mind, and he taught his own kids, that he has a good dog, in his own words, a good dog and a bad dog inside, and they fought, and he always had to try to keep the good dog happy and to keep the good dog. But everywhere I turn, I see that people have their own internal
battle
mechanisms. Mm-hmm. Exactly, of explaining to themselves different inclinations that they might have and different impulses. So we're really excited about this whole project.
Because the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination, you know, our pleasures and desires are so easy at our fingertips to get, sometimes even at our fingertips. It's so easy to do these things in today's world that it's really difficult. You know, I mean, even just maybe 30 or 40 years ago, a lot of the evil things that we do today were not acceptable. So you were ashamed to do them. It was hard to get away with doing these things. Today, everything goes. Kids can do whatever they want. They can do whatever they want with whoever they want, and it's perfectly acceptable. And there's no borders. There's no, steering mechanism to keep them on course. They just think that they're like a sucker when their kids are doing these things, staying out late, doing stuff that they're not supposed to be doing. And what am I doing? I'm not sitting here doing nothing. But when you and I were growing up, good kids were home by 12. You didn't stay. You didn't see good kids out in the streets 1, 2 o'clock in the morning.
Oh, yeah. We've got a very good friend of mine. I have a friend lives in Tel Aviv. His name is Aria Kraus. A very, very fine fellow. I've known him for over 40 years. And he put it very, very well the other day. He said what he likes about this concept is that education very, very often has been, or traditionally it's been, external stimulus. In other words, do what's right because you'll satisfy your parents or your teacher or society, or don't do bad because you'll be punished by a policeman, you'll be punished by the legal system, you'll be punished. In other words, education has traditionally been external stimulus. And what this does, it's not my wisdom, this is the wisdom of King Solomon, who was called the wisest man who ever lived. What this does is it puts a system of checks and balances, and it's all internalized. It's all checking yourself. Is what I'm going to be doing, is my feeling at this moment, is it an impulse from my heart, or is it spontaneous? Is it impulsive? Is it ego forced, or is it from my brain? Is it rational? Is it going to harm anybody else? And that's exactly what it is. It's an internal system, and And we think the world really needs that. We think that that's really what the world really needs at this moment.
And it's good that you're doing it at the Gil Harach, the soft age, the young age, when they're developing their personality. They say, anytime between 0 and 7 years, that's where their main development of their personality is, and that you're getting them young. You used to be, and in fact, I interviewed you once before, you used to be a rabbi or chaplain of a prison here in Israel. So you know what people turn out to be when they listen to the Bad King.
Honestly, there's an article which is supposed to be up any day now in one of the Chabad central site in New York, Chabad.org. And they interviewed me a couple weeks ago, and the young lady who interviewed me, I think it was really a very well-written article. It should be up, it's supposed to be up in Hanukkah. And she says that she feels that one of the things which really pushed me into this project is the fact that I worked in the prisons for 13 years. And until that time, I hadn't thought about it, actually, in terms of what was getting me going. And that's exactly true. Working in the prison for all those years, you see people who only had one king inside of themselves. People who only had the Bad King, and they weren't checking themselves. They weren't thinking. They weren't analyzing their moves, and they weren't. That's correct. That's how they ended up behind bars.
And you saw that. You're right. You had a book called Israel Behind Bars. It was a very interesting book, by the way. And so I guess you get that from there. I have another project for you, Rabbi, when you finish this one.
Okay.
And that is to make, because this is an idea of mine. You know, the youth of today, who are the ones who really have the choices in front of them now, because they're old enough to do what they want to do without mom and dad looking. They can go off. They can, you know, they're strong, virile kids now. It's to make a hip youth series, just like you're doing with this series of The Good King and the Bad King, making CDs and books and everything, to do that for the youth. In other words, make like a television program or something, like once a week, where you have, you remember the Monkees or the Partridge Family or any of those things. You get like a group of teens together that are really hip and cool. Each one has their own personality. You got Yossi, the smart one, and Dahlia, the sweet one, and you got Benny, the one who loves Eretz Israel, the land of Israel, and you got the one that's good in computers, and they're like a group of kids that hang out together that are good kids that love the land of Israel, and they go out on adventures each week, you know, having to save the land of Israel here and going through, you know, moral issues with each other, you know, this one fell and needs support and whatever it is. But you make them really cool. You make lunch boxes with their faces on it, and peaches, you know, and just like they did in the States, and make them role models, because our kids today don't have role models. The role models are people like, I don't know, I mean, I'm sure it's not even that anymore, but like Madonna and I don't know, who are the role models today?
Right,
old hat now, Madonna.
No, right. No,
our kids don't have anybody who's good, who's a role model.
Yeah, that's true. I think it's called positive, there's a word for it in psychology, it's positive, When you give positive role models and you encourage positive behavior and you give encourage positive thinking and positive
I know who our role models are today. Paris Hilton and Lindsay Lohan, and that's what our kids want to be like. That's what people pay $50,000 to Paris Hilton to show up at their kid's birthday party, and it makes their kid just tickled pink. So we need hip, young, good-looking, intelligent, great personality kids to be on the TV every week and get our youth and say, you know what, I want to be like Yossi, or I want to be like Dahlia, or I want to be like this. Oh, isn't he cute? And he's so smart, and he's this, and he's that, and she's so this and that. And they love the land of Israel. I never even thought about hiking the land of Israel. Let's go hiking the land of Israel this vacation. And just to get our kids to want to do good things and really have kosher, good, wholesome role models that are hip, that they are begging to be like, and not like the Paris Hiltons.
Listen, I can't agree with you more. Listen, if we have to look for our good role models in books, So we have to bring them out of the book.
I'm telling you, make a whole series about it. But I'm glad that you're starting from the young age because that's the place to do it. And again, I'd like everybody to go to the website. Again, it's twokingsonline.com, and it's spelled out to T-W-O.
Right.
T-W-O-K-I-N-G-S-O-N-L-I-N-E.com. There you can see the figures, and this is a great, great gift that you can get for your kids, your grandkids, your neighbors' kids, maybe even for adults if you need it.
Let's not forget ourselves. On my website, I also mentioned that we're aiming for kids, but we mean adults too.
Adults too, and it really is. I mean, it's very pleasing for the eyes for adults as well to look at this stuff, and it's very helpful as an aid at night when your kids are going to sleep at night to read them a good book instead of just a Grimm's fairy tale if that's what you're into, or if your kids aren't into Torah stories, or whatever it is,
The truth is, I've got some adult friends of mine who said that the book has actually influenced them also.
That's
they look
great.
At the pictures and they think about the concept and. And the real truth is, even though we're launching a children's series, a tremendous amount of thought was put into the pictures and the storyline itself. For example, the bad king in our series is not somebody who's despicable. We don't depict the bad king, for example, as somebody who's essentially bad. He's not somebody who should be destroyed. He's not somebody that we want to win. He's pictured as somebody who needs to be a little bit maybe educated, to be enlightened, someone we want to bring close to us. And the final picture of the first installment, and this will probably be something which is recurring throughout the series, is that we see the good king and the bad king both smiling as they come to some sort of acceptable resolution.
So they can live together, that you don't have to deny one in order to do the right thing.
Exactly.
Sounds really, really great, and I wish you much luck in it, and I'm eager to see them on the shelves in stores as well, and this is something that we really need, because I'm telling you, the world and humanity has really gone off the deep end. It's so immoral today. It really is, and again, I want to go back to the time when we had something called shame and embarrassment that kept us in line, and which today shame doesn't exist anymore in this world. Everything is out there on the table.
No.
And
100%.
And we have to bring things back to the medium there.
100%.
Well, thank you, Rabbi, for being with us. Rabbi Fishel
Jacobs. Thank you. Let me just wish you again a happy holiday.
And that's these books are all in English.
This first edition is in English. It's been translated. It hasn't been published in Hebrew yet. The Two Kings is actually available in Israel at the present time. I know it's reached bookstores in Jerusalem that I know about. I know it's in California.
And that's in English or Hebrew here?
Excuse me?
That's in English or Hebrew?
The English is available in Jerusalem.
So
I know.
At the bookstores, it's available. It's Damatsky bookstores?
To the best of my knowledge, it's distributed through Shanky's bookstore. Book distributor.
We're in Jerusalem.
I don't know. I don't even know which stores he hits.
I know that
it's in the stores in Jerusalem, and I know it's in California. I know it's in Montreal, and it's of course all over New England. It's in New York, in Connecticut, Massachusetts.
And you can order
it
over the
sure.
internet as well. All right. Thank you, Rabbi Fishel, for being with us.
Thank you very
Rabbi
much,
Rabbi Fishel Jacobs. Thank you
so much. Thank you very much.
All right. And again, the website twokingsonline.com. twokingsonline.com. It's T-W-O for two. And get that for your kids and for your friends' kids as well. Really good things. See, good things are coming out in the world, not just evil. All right, when we get back, we're going to be speaking about the Lost Ten Tribes of Israel, the Khazars, a new book out by Yair Davidi. When we get back, call in. 1-800-270-4288 is the number to call in. We'll be right back.
Aleph Shin, the number one best-selling Jewish techno-thriller novel, was unique for the Jewish market in excitement, imagination, and inspiration. Now, Ten Lost, the prequel to Aleph Shin, is author Sender Zev's latest literary masterpiece. It reveals the mind-boggling background of the awesome tale of Aleph Shin. Now just released, both books in one hardcover volume, two for the price of one, a great Hanukkah gift. Available at Jewish bookstores throughout the United States, England, and Israel. See the ad on Israel National Radio or check out the website at www.tmspublishing.com. That's www.tmspublishing.com.
All right, we're back here at Israel National Radio's Weekend Edition. I'm Tamar Yonah. The Jewish people, when we split into two kingdoms after King Solomon's time, we split to the land of Israel in the north, or the state of Israel in the north, and the state of Judea in the southern part that had the Temple Mount, Jerusalem, etc. And when the northern kingdom was taken over, 10 tribes got lost. They were scattered throughout the world. The Assyrians came in and basically took them off to different places of the world. They expelled the people. That's what conquering armies would often do. And where are they today? Well, perhaps they're coming back. We have a lot of people around the world who are waking up one day and say, you know what? I love Israel. I don't know why. I got to find out more about it. And they go to Yair Davidi's blog called www.britam.org. That's spelled B-R-I-T. A-M, BritAm.org, and they get his books. He's written several books on the lost 10 tribes of Israel, where they have quite possibly migrated to, and they're extremely interesting. And if you believe that somehow you belong the Israelites, and you think you maybe somehow have ancestry that came from the lost tribes or something, maybe just your soul was there, I don't know. And of course we don't know either, but a lot of people feel like they are. You're going to want to check out Yair Davidi's books on the lost 10 tribes of Israel and where they've gone. But Yair Davidi has actually written a new book now, and it's out and available for order, and it's called The Khazars. Now, if you're not familiar with the Khazars, let me read you a quick paragraph from his website at www.britam.org. The Khazars were a semi-nomadic people who became prominent in southern Russia and its neighborhood in the 600s to 900s CE of the Common Era. They were quite powerful, with a far-reaching influence and well-developed civilization. They protected the Jews while giving full citizenship rights to Christians and Muslims who served them faithfully. The Khazars converted to Judaism, and maybe he'll tell us that story of how and why, and henceforth were Jewish. Some people, including many anti-Semites, claim that most Jews today are descended from the Khazars, but this isn't true. There are some, yes, but the Khazars did play a role, and they did contribute to the Jewish nation, and he's going to tell us why in this interview, but more in detail in his books. You're going to want to get that at BritAm.org. So welcome to the show, Yair Davidi.
Shalom, Tamar.
All right, so what made you want to write a book on the Khazars? And first of all, as the Khazars today, would that be, you're saying it's southern Russia, we're talking about like Georgia, where Russia just invaded last summer?
Both Georgia and Armenia and all that area were at one stage dominated by the Khazars. The Khazars did rule over them, but the Khazars themselves were more, or at least when they reached the height of their power, they were a little bit more to the north, along the Don River, along the northern banks of the Black Sea, the southern Ukraine of today, all that area.
So maybe that's why Israel has semi-good relations with Georgia, because of maybe their past, do you think, or it has nothing to do with that?
It could be. The Georgians also have a tradition that the Lost Ten Tribes were in that area, and we trace this tradition to the Khazars and other people. But they could also have been the Georgians themselves could also have been influenced by this presence.
Okay, so why did you write the book? What inspired you?
I wrote the book for several reasons. One of the reasons was because I did research on the Lost Ten Tribes, where the Lost Ten Tribes were, and the Khazars were part of that. The Khazars were part of the whole complex of tribes who we proved descended from Israel, and most of these tribes moved to the west, moved into Western Europe, and some of them remained behind. And those that remained behind, they comprised the bulk of the Khazar nation later converted to Judaism. So this research, much of the research that went into making the book had already done when I wrote the other book, my previous book, concerning Lost Ten Tribes in general.
All right, so I really don't know anything about this, so I'm going to ask you
I just want to put in one more thing. In addition, also because I also am interested in anti-Semitism, why anti-Semites make claims against Jews and so on, and Arabs, etc., And one of the frequent claims that they bring up is the Khazars, saying the Jews were Khazars, so I thought it was important from that point of view as well.
Mm-hmm. But even if they were, so what? They converted and they became part of the Jewish nation.
It's true. That's true. If they were non-Jews and they converted and became part of the Jewish nation, that would be one thing. But why defend a point of view if we don't have to?
Mm-hmm. So,
in other words, it's worth knowing what the truth was. What are the facts before we start saying that? Oh, okay, we're all Khazars. So what? According to the Jewish religion, we can be, and also according to the Bible, according to all the sources. Even if we were, it's enough that we our forefathers accepted the Torah, the same as everyone else did at the Har Sinai. So we're Jews just like everyone else, but it's not true. But if concerning most of the Jewish people, if it's not true, if most of the Jewish people are descended from real Jews, and the whole claim that they are descended from Khazars is not true, then...
Oh, did we lose you, Yair? Yair Davidi. We're trying to get Yair Davidi. Okay, I'm going to let Geula try to call him back and get him back on the phone. I don't know what happened there. I hope that there was... Okay, Geula, you're going to have to write me. Geula's my technician, and she's making all these like hand signals across the glass for me. I have no idea what she wants me to do here. So I'm going to wait until she instant messages me. But again, we were speaking with Yair Davidi. He writes several books on the Lost Ten Tribes of Israel. His website, www.britam.org. Let me see if I still have him on. Yair, are you with us? Okay. All right, so I'm going to maybe try a different line. And try to get him on a different line. So anyway, he writes a lot of books on the Lost Ten Tribes of Israel. And his newest book out is about the Khazars. And according to what I understand about the Khazars is that there was, and I might be wrong. Do we have him back on again?
Sure.
Hi. Okay.
I'm sorry, I don't know what happened.
Okay, no problem. Yeah, we're just glad to have you back. All right. So I just wanted to go back to very basics. I know that you're an expert in this, but I'm going to ask you basic questions about people who don't know anything because I'm one of those people. When the Northern Kingdom of Israel was overtaken and expelled from the land by the occupying forces, and they went to different places in Europe, and they went to the Khazars as well, right? They went to the Khazars as well, that area?
Yes, the area of the Khazars.
Did they just kick them out and say, go wherever you want? I mean, how did it happen that one tribe mostly went to Britain, and one tribe mostly went to Holland, and one tribe mostly went to the Khazars, and one tribe mostly went to France? I mean, how did that work?
No, the Assyrians had a policy of conquering other peoples. They didn't only do it to the Israelites, they did it to most places that they conquered. They would take whole groups of people and uproot them and take them to and transport them to different sections of the Assyrian Empire.
Mm-hmm.
And in that way, they were able to break them up and to have an easier control over them.
Right.
Also, make them dependent upon themselves. Put them in border areas where they had to defend themselves, and incidentally, also help defend the Assyrian Empire and be dependent upon the Assyrian Empire. And that also absorb them into their whole administrative framework. Some of them some of them slaves. They enslaved some of them on their building projects. And others, they made conscripted whole units into their armies. Okay, so this is what the Assyrians did. And also the Romans later did this. It had a similar system. Quite a few ancient empires had this system.
Okay, so later comes the Khazars. They're in control of the region now. This is years later. Jews end up there somehow.
Okay.
And what happens? How does this whole thing come where the king decides, you know what? I'm going to be a Jew, and we're converting all the people of the Khazars to Jews. How did that happen?
Okay, so somehow the Assyrian Empire broke up, and so the different peoples who were in the different portions of the Assyrian Empire re-emerged as independent entities. And there were Israelites. There were Khazars, the people known as the Khazars, who had in the region of Georgia, as you mentioned Armenia and so on. And after that, The Arabs converted to Islam. Muhammad united, of course, the Arabian tribes to unite, and they came out of the Arabia. They conquered the land of Israel, as it was that, the land of Israel, Syria, and Persia. And then they attacked the Byzantine Empire. The Byzantine Empire was the eastern section of the Roman Empire at that time, which occupied with the present-day area of Turkey. And they also attacked the Khazars.
How unusual of the Muslims to attack people. Go ahead.
And they attacked the Khazars. And so the Khazars were allied with the Byzantines, and they fought against the Arabs. And somehow the Arabs pushed them up into southern Russia, over north of the Caucasus Mountains.
Okay.
The Caucasus Mountains.
Mm-hmm.
And there the Khazars fought against them. And this went on for a few hundred years.
Now, were the Khazars pagans? What were they?
Yes, they were. At that time, they were pagans. They had a pagan religion or a religion similar to that of the other peoples in the area.
Okay.
But they did. There are traces of Jewish customs, of Israelite customs, of Israelite traditions that existed even from the earliest of times in Khazar areas. This is long before they became Jewish.
All right. And so what happened now? How did it happen that the Khazars converted to Judaism?
So there's a legend that the Khazars repeat that at one stage one of their leaders, one of them, the head of their military forces, was in effect Jewish. And he...
So his chief of staff was a Jew?
Yeah, that's right. The chief of staff was Jewish.
Okay.
And the surrounding nations started, the Arabs and the other nations threatened the Khazars. They wanted they said it was disrespectful to them. It was disrespectful to them to have such a person, to have to deal with such a person, with a Jew in such a position. And so he arranged that there should be a debate between Jews, the Christians, and Muslims.
Okay.
And this is what the Khazars themselves say.
All right.
And as a result of this debate, the king himself decided to convert. And they also discovered indications that they themselves were of Jewish religion. They found ancient manuscripts in a cave in the Caucasus area. And the king himself decided to convert, he and his court. And then eventually, they didn't accept a full yoke of Judaism, as what we would call, possibly they had something similar to what we'd call B'nai Noach in our times. But over a short period, 50 years, 60 years, 70 years, they accepted a full-scale Judaism, according to the Orthodox Judaism, what we'd call today.
And, Did they have to take courses? I mean, who converted them?
So first of all, as a background to their conversion, Jews had always been, there were a lot of Jews in their kingdom, and they'd always been friendly towards the Jews, or they were friendly to anyone. Even Muslims used to flee to them and come and work for them because they'd get better conditions with them. They were fair people. They were liberally minded.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of Jews were being persecuted both by the Christians and the Byzantine Empire, and also by the Muslims. So a lot of Jews were fleeing, were moving into this area.
Right.
So there were a lot of Jews about to convert them, and they themselves had a tradition that they were descended from Israelites, and they did have some type of tradition, some type of customs. There was something there. In other words, they were genuine converts, and there were plenty of rabbis around, or Jews who knew enough to convert them at that time, to make their assimilation into the Jewish people to facilitate their entrance into the Jewish people. Also, they were not that so numerous. There were not that many of them, but they were very powerful. They ruled over a great number of other peoples through a system of alliances and collection of tribute.
Mm-hmm. Well, this must have made news headlines around the world, even though they didn't have daily newspapers, but still it's an amazing thing to have a whole country and their king at one time convert. It kind of reminds me, Lahavdil, not comparing it all here, of Shechem, when they all went and circumcised themselves so he could marry Dina. But this, of course, is not the same type of story. But this is an amazing thing to have a king and a whole nation convert. Did the people who were in his nation, like the Christians and Muslims, also convert to Judaism?
No.
Or just the Khazar people themselves?
Just the Khazar people themselves. And a portion of some of the other people. So there's also another people called the Alans, who were allied with the Khazars. A portion of them also converted, and a few of the other peoples. Most of the subject peoples did not convert. Most of the subject peoples remained pagans and remained Muslims and Christians. And they served under the Khazars, and the Khazars also had local councils where they try and give equal representation to each of the major religions under their domain, or proportional representation according to their the numbers in their population of that religion.
Did the people have to convert? Was this a decree or an edict of the king? Or it's only the people who wanted to, and it was the majority of the population, so we say that the Khazars all converted?
According to the documents that we have, the Khazars converted in stages. Not all of them converted. We also have records of Khazars who became Christians, Khazars who became Muslims, but most of them did convert, and apparently their conversion was considered something that they were going to do nationally, that they had to do nationally, and they did have a genuine belief that they were descended from Israelites.
So Israelites had been in that area. Didn't really want to be a Jew. Were they converted to Judaism?
They were converted to Judaism, yes.
They were, against their will?
Who?
The king made them convert?
No one made them convert. It was something that they considered
that
it
they
their national duty
but,
to do.
But the problem here is that there could be lots of good, decent people. They were Khazars, let's say. Okay, let's say there's some good, decent Khazars who said, you know what? I heard the debate. I heard it, and the Jews are right. The other stuff doesn't make sense. The authentic, you know, God's writings are from the Torah, and that's where it is. And I believe in Judaism, but I'm not ready to take on all those 613 commandments. You know, I just don't know if I want to never eat a ham sandwich again or whatever it is. How do we absorb a people into Judaism, which is a priestly nation, which is supposed to be a light into the world, of people who say, yeah, I believe, but I don't really want to do it? If they're Jews already and they don't want to do it, that's one thing. We're not talking about that. But to take in a people who don't want to commit fully to being a Jew, why would we take them in?
The impression is, so first of all, we only have a few documents. Going on the documents we have in traditions, the impression is that they wanted to do it, that this was something that they considered, as the Khazars, they were proud of what they were. They considered themselves different from the other peoples. They had a tradition that they were descended from Israelites. And they considered, and they came to the conclusion that as Khazars, if they wanted to remain part of their nation, they had to convert to Judaism. And not all of them did, as I said before, but the majority, this is what the majority accepted. Mm-hmm. And maybe they had Ruach HaKodesh, maybe there was some type of divine inspiration amongst them, maybe it was something similar to the renewal of the covenant that is promised that would happen to the lost ten tribes in the Zohar. All kinds of possible explanations. Historically, it's a fact that they did do so, they did convert to Judaism, and they were kosher Jews. They did keep the mitzvot.
They were kosher Jews and kept the mitzvot.
Yes.
You can
ask me why and how. It's a fact that they did, you know. It's another question.
I understand. When did the Khazars die out? Because they're not around today.
So first of all, they ruled over a large area. They were very powerful. At one stage, they even penetrated Europe. They dominated Hungary, possibly Austria, parts of Poland, Ukraine, all that area. Also in the east, the east, parts of Central Asia of today, they had a wide-ranging empire, and they were very powerful and culturally, also culturally advanced. We also find, before they converted, we find a group of them had passed into Scotland and became part of the Pict peoples in Scotland. We also find Khazars before they converted, groups of them in Scandinavia, but that's a different story. What happened to them in the end? After they converted, they continued to exist as they were for several hundred years, and then they began to suffer from attacks from the neighboring people, or possibly too liberal, too free, with strong rulers there weren't that many of them, and they did not rule with a heavy hand, as if to say. So they lost control of some of the peoples they were ruling over, and they suffered from attacks. And about in the 900 CE, they were attacked both by the Russians, who were just coming up, and by the Byzantines, and after that, they continued to exist in small groups scattered here and there for a few hundred more years. And eventually, they get these independent, smaller entities also succumb to attacks by the Mongols, by the Tatars, by the Turks, by everyone around them. And they disappeared, and most of them merged with the Jewish people. Some of them remained in Russia. And later on, we had a phenomenon in Russia of the Subotniks. You've heard of them?
Subotniks?
The Subotniks, much later in Russia, there were groups of Russian peasants. This was maybe a long time later, possibly almost not a th- about 800, 700 years later in parts of southern Russia, the groups of Russian peasants who adopted Judah, who began to, first of all, adopt Jewish customs and remain Christians, and eventually many of them also became Jewish. And some of these Subotniks also had traditions that they too were descended from the Khazars.
Now, how many people are we talking about? Because there's a lot of Ashkenazim in the world, and there were even more, 6 million more Ashkenazim in the world before the Holocaust. And a lot of anti-Semites are saying that all of the Ashkenazim are not Jews, that they were from the Khazars, and that they're not authentic Jews at all. What do you have to say about that?
So the impression is that they were not so numerous. There were not so many of them. First of all, even if there were so many of them, they themselves were both of Jewish and of lost Israelite ancestry. Apart from that, there were not that many of them to start with. There are a few thousand, but they had been very powerful and had a wide-ranging influence. And this few thousand did become absorbed amongst the Jewish people, but they didn't. There's not much. Concrete evidence of their presence.
So most of the Ashkenazi Jews are Jews who just migrated to different places in Europe through exiles and harsh government decrees against them in other countries.
Yes.
All right. You have like about a minute left. What is the gist of your book? What are people going to come away with after reading the history of the Khazars?
They're going to come away with a history, very interesting history, a story which is not known to very many. Also, the knowledge that the Khazars were descended from Israel. As Israelites, they were related to certain peoples in Western Europe who also descend from Lost Ten Tribes, and that the Khazars were something to be something to have been proud of. That they're a heroic nation. They achieved a lot with very little going for them.
Well, it sounds very interesting. I like history. I like learning about what happened to the Jews and how they migrated and what happened and different nations. And I love to read about debates between religions if it happened already, so it's very quick and brief. But we learn a lot from them as well. And I want to thank you for being on the show. And again, if anybody wants to order Yair Davidi's newest book out called The Khazars, go to his website at www.britam.org, O-R-G, B-R-I-T-A-M, like in mother, britam.org, and you'll see the book on, if you scroll down a little bit, click on the book and it'll take you to a very big page where the Khazars are, and you can order that. It's still Hanukkah today. You can order that for your friends or family, and you won't get the book today, but you can just print off a little card that's beautifully colored on his website and tell them that I got you this book. It should be coming in the mail soon. Yair Davidi, thank you for being with us, and thank you for all the work you do. You're helping so many people around the world who really want to connect closer to God, and we appreciate that.
Thank you, Tamla. Thank you.
All right. And in another 34 seconds, we're going to be hearing the news, and then we're going to be hearing Walter Bingham. He's here live in the studio here at IsraelNationalRadio.com in Beth Dell. He's going to be here. If you're in the virtual studio, don't go anywhere, because Walter's coming right in live with you. And you can call into a show as well, 1-800-270-4288. I'll be back with you tomorrow morning, Israel time, or tonight, midnight, New York Eastern time, with Professor Paul Eidelberg and some more about what's going on with the war here in Israel. Thanks, everyone, for being with us. It was great meeting you.
Cut down on time at the airport. Introducing the ultimate airport experience by Menashe Sofer's Airport Service. It's the first of its kind. The VIP meet and assist shuttle guarantees a completely stress-free traveling experience to and from Ben-Gurion International Airport online at msoferairport.com. Tell them you heard about it on Israel National Radio. Menashe Sofer Airport Travel, Speed and Service. MSOPHER Airport.com.